Today, though, as I say, we're looking at Myanmar, straight after the extraordinary election result that you all watched with interest and indeed with a lot of pleasure over the last few days. I have three speakers. The first one on my right is Mark Canning. He's a former senior British diplomat. He's a noted Southeast Asia specialist. He was British ambassador to Indonesia and to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. He left Foreign Office in September 2014. He served earlier as British Ambassador to Myanmar between 2006 and 2009. A lot of other things, but I'm not going to go through the whole lot. But as you will see from that, he has a very firm and deep background in the subject we're discussing today. My second speaker, my immediate left, will be Rushanara Ali, who is a Labour Member of Parliament for Bethnal Green and Bow. You'll remember she defeated George Galloway. About which I will say no more, I'm sure we all have our views on that. She's one of the first three Muslim women elected to Parliament, and the first person of British Bangladeshi heritage to be elected. She grew up in the constituency, and she studied at Oxford philosophy, politics, and economics. And so we look forward to hearing from her on this subject. And my last speaker is Dr. Richard Cockett, who is on my far left, who's editor and correspondent of The Economist. He's reported from Latin America, Africa, and Asia for The Economist. He was Southeast Asia correspondent from 2010 to 2014. He's the author of several books, the latest of which, called Blood, Dreams, and Gold, The Changing Face of Burma, is on sale at the back of the room today. If you wish to buy one, and I'm sure if you do, he would be prepared and happy to sign it for you. But as I say, I always like to set a question for my panel. Today it is From Dictatorship to Democracy, A New Era for Myanmar? Question mark. On that basis, I'm going to ask Mark Canning if you'd speak to us.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It's very good to be here. Thank you, Chairman. The sad events in France and in the Middle East have rather crowded out what's been happening in Myanmar in recent days. But the news from there so far has been extraordinarily good. We are not at the end of an election process. In fact, we're not even halfway through it, but so far, so good. Just to recap where we appear to be and how it works, the election that took place a few days ago is for seats in the upper and the lower house of the Myanmar parliament. The military holds a 25% block in those houses. So the barrier to entry, if you like, for Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy is pretty high. They had to win. If they were going to win a working majority, they had to win two-thirds of the open votes. So you had the first stage of the process on the 8th of November. And in the middle of March, you have the second stage of the process when the newly elected MPs and the 25% military then elect a new president. And everything that flows from that, the members of the cabinet. As far as we know, and others may have more recent information, we've had about 50% of the seats counted. And so far, the National League for Democracy seems on course for a landslide victory of the sort that they achieved in 1990. But, of course, mention of 1990 does flag up the risks that lie ahead. The NLD won a sweeping victory in that year, but, of course, that was overturned by the military. But so far, so good. The election has been conducted very well. There have been problems around elements of the voters' register and other things, but I don't think anyone has suggested anything that points to a systematic effort to undermine the credibility of the election. They've allowed observers to come in from the EU and various other places. And the military and the president, who is a former military man, President Thein Sein, have been very generous and very open in the last day or two in acknowledging the scale of the victory and their determination to uphold that result. This election, though, was a very big deal. It's been the first real test of democracy, the first head-to-head, if you like, between the National League for Democracy and the USDP. The USDP effectively is the military's political vehicle. And this is the first head-to-head genuine contest since 1990, and that, of course, was an election that didn't end up being fulfilled. We now enter, assuming that the NLD gets what you could call a supermajority, which allows them the whip hand to nominate the president in March, we now have rather an extraordinary period where the existing MPs, many of whom will have lost their seats, continue to sit until then, and then the new intake comes in and elects the president. But it's a period, I think, that will be full of horse trading, full of uncertainty, and I think full of political risk. Just to highlight a few of the challenges. The first is a practical challenge. Who, assuming that the NLD have the ability to nominate the president, who will they nominate? Because Aung San Suu Kyi herself is prohibited under the 2008 constitution. Because she has two foreign-born sons, she's prohibited from holding that office. It's not impossible that some sort of deal is done in the intervening period to change that, but at the moment that's the position. And so she has to nominate someone from her party, or possibly someone who is a pan-political figure, if you like, to be the president. She's rather grandly said, it doesn't matter who's president, it will actually be me, and I'll be calling the shots, which I didn't think was an entirely wise thing to say. But there is an issue there. It's conceivable that the current president, President Thein Sein, who's done a very good job, by and large, since he came to power in 2011, it's conceivable there might be some sort of deal to allow him there. But the fact is, we don't know. But some challenges looking ahead. The first and the most important is to maintain the comfort levels of the military. The military, as I said, overturned the result in 1990. In recent months, they've shown distinct nervousness at the way things were going on two occasions. The first is their refusal to change the constitution to allow her to become president. And the second was to depose the head of their party, the USDP, because he was perceived to have moved rather too close to the NLD. But there were clear signals that the military were getting twitchy and they wanted to restore a bit more control. So this is going to demand a real generosity of spirit from Aung San Suu Kyi. She's going to have to reach out to the military. She's going to have to include them. She is going to have to pull together a government really of all the talents. And it is not true that you can look at the NLD and say all good and the USDP all bad. There have actually been some remarkably good reforming figures amongst the former military people. Not all of them, but some of them. And she needs to pull together a government that brings them together. And the second reason she needs to do that is because the NLD does not have the talent to do it. It is comprised of many, many courageous, brave people. But the upper tiers, the average age is well over 70, if not higher. They do not have any experience of running a country. That's no fault of their own. But she needs to reach out across the divides. The next one I would say is national unity. Myanmar is an extraordinary country. It's been in a state of low-level conflict since 1949. President Thein Sein and his government have done a very good job over the last couple of years trying to strike peace agreements with the many, many ethnic groups that lie around the fringes, the Shan, the Mon, the Kachin. And all of these, to varying degrees, were at war with the what's called the Burman Center. And so that has been tackled, but not fully. And that's one thing that will actually bear on the comfort levels of the military quite heavily. The other issue of national unity is one around the Rohingya people, the Muslim peoples who live in the northwest of Myanmar and who have been appallingly marginalized for many, many years. They are often derided as sort of newly arrived outsiders, but they have been there for generations. And it has been disappointing to see the way that all the politicians, including Aung San Suu Kyi, have not stood up for what is a glaring omission of human rights. So I'm hoping that when the election is out of the way, the Rohingya get a better deal than they've had for many, many generations. The economy is a major challenge for whoever takes power. The economy's moved forward quite well since 2011, but from a very low level. There is a real challenge around the lack of capacity within the economy, the lack of people with the required levels of experience and education to run that country. And I think the final challenge I would highlight is for us, for the international community. There have been sanctions in place against Myanmar, or Burma as some still call it, for many years. The EU and many other countries, Australia, Canada, scaled back their sanctions a couple of years back. They've left in place sanctions against military sales, which is fine. But the Americans still have some very powerful residual sanctions in place against a number of named individuals. Now, those individuals, some of them are very bad, some of them less so. But the point I come away with is that they cast a smell over Myanmar, and they complicate doing business there in a whole range of ways. And the issue of who was on the sanctions list and who was allowed off it was taken forward in a very hurried and a random way. And for every person that's on that list still, I can name a number that are off it who are every bit as good or bad as the ones that are there. So my hope is that these sanctions are really slimmed down to the people, for example, that might have been in the drug business or the arms business. But the general tier of sleazy businessmen, I think could be taken off. And they could be taken off in a whole range of ways. They could be required to sign up to a particular code of practice. Because I fear if we don't do it, and as I say, I don't have a brief to speak for these guys, I fear if we don't do it, it will act as a continuing disincentive to business to engage there. So I think I'll leave it there, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm now going to call Mishanara Ali. I should have said that until 2014, she was actually Shadow Minister of International Development, and obviously that has a bearing on what we're talking about today. Mishanara, if you could address us.
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to start off by recognising the significance of where Burma has got to. When I was a kid, I was distinctly aware of the experience of Aung San Suu Kyi being under house arrest. You know, alongside what was happening in South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement in Asia, she was this great figure that was being denied the opportunity to lead her party and lead her country towards democracy. So it's clear, and it goes without saying, that Burma has come a long way, and she epitomizes so much that is good about Burma, Myanmar. And I think it's a credit to the international community and many in this room, I'm sure, who've been involved with campaigns for democracy in Burma. And where the country has got to now is a great source of hope and optimism. And I very much hope, like everybody else, that the transition towards the NLD getting into power happens smoothly in the light of these recent elections and their success. I wanted to focus on a few key points. Mark's already highlighted some of the issues around what governance might look like. And it goes without saying that the fact that the military will still hold 25% of the seats, they've got about 40 seats. The fact that, my understanding is that some of the key positions, key ministries, will still be held by the military, means that there will be limits to what the new government will be able to do. So that requires the international community to work with the new government as well as the military to make sure that genuine democracy is practiced in the coming years. And I think that the area that I have particular concern about, as I know many others do, is around what happens going forward. In the elections, certain groups were denied the right to participate in the recent elections, particularly ethnic groups who were disenfranchised. One of those groups, of course, includes the Rohingya community in Burma, who have experienced huge amounts of exclusion, who've been displaced following the conflicts in 2012 and beyond. So one of the tests will be for the new government, how do they include those minority groups, Christian minorities, other minority groups who've been in conflict, into a new inclusive society that looks forward, that deals with some of the internal conflicts within the country. Because if that is not addressed, then it's likely to undermine the achievements so far. And I think that's where the international community has a big responsibility in not turning its back on the country, but thinking that all is well because there is a new government and so on. And as Mark has pointed out already, Aung San Suu Kyi has been pretty reticent. And of course people can understand some of the constraints within which she's been working in, but she has been reticent in condemning the appalling violence and exclusion that certain groups like the Rohingya community have experienced. In 2013, when I was Shadow Development Minister, I visited Rakhine State in Burma. And as most of you will know, this is an area where the Rohingya population is concentrated in, and following the violence led by Buddhist extremist groups, some 140,000 Rohingya Muslims were displaced, and there has been a constant cycle of violence against them. And some of the things that I saw in the camps were shocking to the extreme. And I know that others, whether it's the UN Secretary General and other leading figures in the international community, the UK ambassador, other foreign governments, have highlighted just how appalling the circumstances are within which Rohingya communities live in these displaced camps. The lack of access to primary care in these camps, the lack of access to doctors, even in extreme emergencies, which means that the death rates in these camps are appalling, at an appalling level. The UN having very limited access, as well as NGOs into the camps to provide assistance. The lack of basic food, sanitation, and other assistance to these places. What does all that mean for Burma in the future? For Myanmar in the future? It means that if we, you know, the big challenges are going to be, particularly in a state like Rakhine State, where the economic situation is pretty, it's a state where it's not just the Rohingya population, but the wider population is less well off than other parts of the country. There's been less development, less investment. So one of the tasks will be to make sure that there's greater economic development in Rakhine State. The relationships between the different communities was better in the past but has been exploited by extremist groups. So one of the tests will be economic development for regions like that, but also more genuine efforts to deal with the discrimination, deal with the exclusion of Rohingya groups, while at the same time making sure that that the other groups do not continue to blame or use Rohingya communities as a scapegoat. That requires leadership. That requires the new government to make absolutely clear that they will protect the rights and extend the rights of Rohingya groups, Rohingya minorities. At the moment, they're not even allowed to define themselves in the census as Rohingya. They have been required to call themselves Bengali, and there has been considerable resistance. And our government funded that census to the objection of many organisations, human rights organisations, as well as those within the country. So the citizenship issue has got to now be settled. For too long, the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi in particular have been reticent to address those issues because of the political circumstances. But as they take over the government, it's absolutely critical that there's leadership around citizenship, around making sure that the Rohingya population that are now in these camps are able to return to the places they were living in, that there is a transition back to normality, back to having the opportunity to live their lives, and the treatment of those groups, which is so appalling, is addressed. Now, that means that the international community needs to continue to apply pressure. If justice and equality is not integral to what the new government does, if human rights are not integral to what happens to minorities, then I believe that that will undermine the progress that Myanmar could be set to make in the coming years. So those, the economic development, the pursuit of human rights and equality and justice has to go hand in hand with a new democracy. And it's the onus is on all of us to make sure that we act as critical friends with the new government to make sure that the interests of those groups that have been neglected for so long are supported. And that we speak up for those groups, because for too long there hasn't been sufficient progress. And I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
I'll now ask Richard Cotton to speak to us.
Hello. Well, since I'm last, and what I'm going to do is rather than dwell on the results of this election, the meaning of it, etc., I broadly agree with what the past two speakers have said about that. It is an extraordinary event for Burma, considering what's happened there over the last four or five decades since military rule took over in 1962. But I'm going to cast this back a bit and put it in a bit of a historical perspective, which is really the purpose of my book, Blood, Dreams and Gold, where the first two-thirds of the book is really a sort of encapsulation of an interpretation of Burmese history from the early colonial period and before, and how that has shaped the present, and also poses all the political difficulties which the new NLD government and the new governors of Burma will now have to try and overcome. And I want to get into that by pointing out two things about the election results. Both speakers have touched on this before. First of all, no single Muslim MP was elected in Burma. Burma has a Muslim population of officially 4%. Most commentators think it's probably nearer 8%. I would put it actually probably at 10%. And several less Muslim MPs, at least two, than were MPs in the last parliament. Secondly, the ethnic minority parties, the Kachin, Chin, etc., they did terribly badly relative to what most people had expected, certainly compared to what I expected. They have 32 seats at the moment. All the seats aren't in, 80% of the votes in. But as things stand at the moment, they have 32 seats in the lower house. That's only four more than the defeated military proxy party, the USDP. And in the upper house, they have only 11 which is actually less than the USDP, which has 12. So basically, these two particular results of a general result point to some of the sort of imbalances in Burmese society and some of the problems that we'll face in addressing these imbalances going forwards. Now, where do these imbalances, these particular problems, come from? The first, say, two-thirds of my book I call The Plural Society and Its Enemies, which gives me the template for understanding Burma. Now, what is the plural society? Many of you probably will understand it in the West, as meaning a concept of a society, a plural society, which is happily integrated, where everybody is mixing, where all the races are happily coinciding with each other, etc. Not at all. In fact, the term the plural society was coined by a British civil servant and colonial administrator, an academic called John Sydenham Furnival, who lived in colonial Rangoon, it was then called, in the 1930s and 1940s. So he watched colonial society evolve, and also he was an expert on Indonesia. So the plural society is a coin he termed to describe both colonial Rangoon and Batavia in what is now Indonesia. And what he meant by that was the influx, the mass immigration of foreigners who came in to British Burma during the colonial period, to build the colonial society at the behest of the colonial masters, i.e. the British, or in the Indonesian case, the Dutch. And what he observed in the famous passage in his book on this is that all the people came in and they lived side by side, but did not mingle and they didn't integrate. And as he put it, they met only in the marketplace. They were only there, in other words, to trade and do commerce. And in his famous phrase, he said, and so not mingling, there was no what he called social will, or what I guess we would now call integration. Two consequences of this. First of all, Burma became very, very rich. It was one of the most prosperous of the colonial societies in Southeast Asia before the Second World War. The Second World War ruined the economy. But the second consequence is that the imposition of a plural society on the indigenous Burmans was bitterly resented by them. Because basically, the incomers not only took all the jobs, but all the new development of Burma was in the hands of these incomers. A lot of them were South Asians, i.e. Indians, and a lot of them were Muslims. And they came to Yangon, they came to Mandalay, Moulmein, all the entrepots, and particularly Akyab, what is now Sitwe, where the Rohingya are. So when the British left in 1947, the Burmans who took over, particularly the Burman generals after 1962, their primary aim was to destroy the plural society, which they felt had pushed them aside and had taken over the country. Several consequences flowed from this. First of all, they privatised all businesses in the country in the 1960s, so hundreds of thousands, privatised foreign-owned businesses, so hundreds of thousands of people of Indian origin, Chinese origin, Anglo-Burmese, were forced out of the country, and they left in their droves. Secondly, this started a programme of Burmanisation, which was an attempt to reclaim their country from the foreigners, as they saw it. And the really damaging thing about this is that they extended this to the indigenous ethnic minorities on the borders, the Kachin, the Chin, etc., and the Rohingya, although the Rohingya were even worse, they were never even given citizenship. At least the indigenous ethnic minorities were citizens. And this campaign of Burmanization was linguistic, it was cultural, it was moral, it was military. It was an attempt to, for total, if you like, cultural and political control of the country by the Burman majority. This ignited the great backlash of the ethnic minorities who were fighting civil wars against the Burman majority, really pretty well since the year of independence, 1948. And it also, from time to time, brought on a policy of anti-Muslimization and of oppression, non-recognition of the remaining Muslims in the country. Now, these have been some of the main fault lines in Burmese history, in modern Burmese history, and they continue to this day. So I would argue that this election has to be seen in that context. It's one aspect of a wider attempt to deal with these fault lines in Burman society and has to be considered besides other attempts to try and attempt some reconciliation between these fault lines. Now, in that sense, I would argue this election actually, it helps a bit, but doesn't help that much. The fact that no Muslim MP has been appointed, has been elected, is very disappointing and will leave the Muslim minority. It's not just a minority, this is the second largest religious ethnic minority in the country. They're far more numerous than, say, the Baptists or the Catholics, etc. So this is a significant minority, quite apart from the 800,000 Rohingya already mentioned. And secondly, it will leave the ethnic minority part, a lot of the ethnic minority parties, etc., feeling of this election that they've missed out. It'll leave them feeling vulnerable, and it'll leave them wondering what their role will be in the new Burma. So, a couple of consequences I think will flow from that. First of all, on the ethnic minorities, as well as finding accommodation with the military, which Mark Canning has talked about, just as important will be how the NLD now negotiate the future with the ethnic minorities. Because what they've told me in the past few days, looking at research outs, is that they don't want to swap one majoritarian, authoritarian Burman party, the NLD, for the one that has just lost, the USDP. That in the end, I think everybody has agreed, somehow Burma has to move forward to a federal solution to find an entirely new institutional framework in which all the ethnic minorities, including the Muslims, can live peacefully together. So it's an open question about whether this election moves that process further on. Some people are afraid that it doesn't. So the task, amongst many others, for the NLD government, which will undoubtedly take power next year, is then how to negotiate this new federal state with the ethnic minorities, bearing in mind that they have this huge landslide majority, and the people then are going to negotiate with on this are going to feel now vulnerable and underrepresented. Secondly, of course, the Muslim question, as well as for Rohingya, 800,000 Rohingya, who are not citizens of Burma, there are hundreds of thousands of people in Burma of Muslim origin who are also not citizens, who have no rights, who are not allowed employment in any government bureaucracy, who are not allowed to be teachers, etc., etc. So even if you have a sort of formal citizenship in Burma, it's been very, very rare up to now that you've been included in the mainstream of life. That has to change too. And so human and civil rights have to be given now to everyone in Burma, not just for Rohingya, although the Rohingya, of course, are the most pressing case. So my argument really from looking at the history of the plural society and how modern Burma came to be about, how these fault lines came to appear, is that there's still an awful lot of work to do from these elections. And these elections are not, I would say, very clear-cut in whether they help to move this process forwards or not. So I'll leave it there.